This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Natalia Melman Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2. And of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everyone. I want to talk about something important today, because it's time to get back to our roots around free expression on Facebook and Instagram.
Free expression. That's a phrase the bosses of some of the big social media companies are using a lot, including Meta's CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, who you just heard there. That clip was from a video shared in January, announcing some major changes to the way the social media giant will label and moderate some of its posts in the US. His argument? That fact-checking has become too politically biased, undermining trust rather than creating it, because in his words, there are too many mistakes, and that leads to what he calls censorship. Instead, Meta seems to be following X's lead and pivoting to community notes, where users, rather than professional fact-checkers and experts, decide what's accurate. So does that mean more free speech and fewer mistakes? Or are users at greater risk of being misled by false posts? To answer those questions, I've tracked down former insiders from the social media companies, users themselves, and social psychologists. I'm Mariana Spring, and for BBC Trending, this is Can Community Notes Clean Up Your Feed? Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Mariana Spring from BBC Trending, and this is Can Community Notes Clean Up Your Feed?
The way it's now perceived is, well, if you have fact checkers, you can't have community notes. And if you have community notes, well, fact checkers are useless. And that's kind of tough.
This is Sam Freeman. Mark Zuckerberg used to be his boss when he worked on protecting user safety at Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook. He started working at the company in 2020, just as COVID-19 swept the world. It was a time when there was an avalanche online of mistruths, dubious claims, speculation and conspiracy theories. And there was public pressure on the social media companies, including from advertisers, to stop the spread of false information.
Everything on the internet kind of sucks half the time. But then you see this during COVID, you see this widespread medical misinformation, and it's new. And how do you deal with that quickly so that you kind of don't leave your users vulnerable?
Does that mean you were there when the fact-checking partnerships started to be a thing or more of a thing during the pandemic?
Yeah, mostly more noticeable. And then you'd start seeing more warnings on posts. So you'd start seeing this has been fact-checked or this is likely to not be true. And then you'd have more of a blurring and a warning underneath individual posts as well.
But now, 5 years later, the approach being taken by Meta appears to have changed a lot. What did Sam make of Mark Zuckerberg's announcement?
I found it quite surprising. You see, seemingly out of nowhere, a kind of change to three major areas. You have the changing of fact checkers to community notes. You have the changing of lesser harms. I know this is a podcast, but I'm doing lesser in quotation marks. Lesser harms to being relying on user reports. And then also a change of their hate speech policy to hate content, which disproportionately impacts those who are already marginalised.
Mark Zuckerberg's video was emblematic of a wider debate happening. Is it possible to protect social media users' freedom of expression and also protect them from harmful content? Or are the two ideas fundamentally incompatible? This debate was turbocharged back in 2022 when Elon Musk bought X, previously called Twitter. He released internal documents called the Twitter Files to explain why he believed the company hadn't been fairly applying its misinformation policies. It sparked valid debates about accounts and posts being unfairly suspended or removed. But Sam felt that it unfairly painted all of those who worked across different social media sites, and fact-checkers too, as being inherently biased.
Trust and safety detection mechanisms and automated systems are built around the platform's policies. So they're not built by specific engineers who have a sense of bias or sense of moral kind of opinion on how they want to treat pieces of content.
They were called Birdwatch when I was there. That's the one feature that I know of that's still on the site.
That's Lisa Jennings Young. She worked at X, then Twitter, at around the same time Sam worked at Meta. And the feature she's describing, called Birdwatch, is the first version of what we now call community notes on the social media site.
And that allows, you know, people on the platform to put notes there. So it's something that's interesting and it is still on the site and I think it can be useful. It's not enough.
Similar to how Wikipedia works, volunteers or bird watchers could edit and correct tweets they thought contained misinformation. Is this system that Meta has said it plans to introduce in the US to replace fact-checking, taking a leaf out of X's book? Lisa's job at Twitter involved designing all sorts of features like this before she left at the end of 2022 after Elon Musk's takeover of the site. The idea was to limit the spread of hate and disinformation by adding new tools or prompts that could impact what people share.
Some of my favorites were the nudge for reducing retweets of articles that you hadn't read. And that was one of the ones that was really, really had an impact on reducing the spread of misinformation.
Lisa's team also designed labels applied to misleading tweets. Criticism of fact-checking has often focused on the choice of language or the idea it could further entrench people's views. For Lisa, it was about making the labels on Twitter neutral and non-judgmental.
Let's say we had prototypes of maybe five different options. And we would, with, you know, a large number of users, we would show those prototypes and walk them through the same script, you know, to assess how they responded, right? So in that way, you could see, okay, this one is the most neutral language, which is what we're trying to go for.
The same kinds of considerations went into the design of Birdwatch, now Community Notes. Lisa says her team, before they were laid off in 2022, along with thousands of other employees at Twitter, would analyse different research to better understand how people behave online.
We worked super, super closely with our researchers, social scientists, many of them. And one of the things that I was really digging into, which I hope to continue to do in my career, is how those social science theories for persuasive messaging can be, you know, effective when you're trying to change behavior.
Her team worked with people like Melissa Basol, a social psychologist who studied at Cambridge University.
Shame is absolutely not the way to go.
Her research focuses on how we can use psychological theories to combat mis and disinformation. If we understand how we, as human beings, respond to stuff that's not true or could cause harm online, we, and the social media companies, in her view, can better protect ourselves from it.
A lot of research shows actually that a good portion know that sometimes the information they share or retweet is not necessarily true, but it reflects a sentiment and an ideology and it rings true, and that is enough. And I wonder if the fact-checking component or the community notes component now goes, yeah, and what? What are you going to do about it? And there's a bit of a rebellious part to it. And so I think it's an interesting dynamic how it splits people and the reactions to being fact-checked or called out online.
I've tracked down some users who are regularly community noted on X because of their misleading posts. I messaged back and forth with them. Several of these are accounts that have purchased blue ticks on the site, offering their posts more prominence. I've analysed their posts and often they're not labelled until they've amassed tens or hundreds of thousands of views. Several tell me how they would never delete a post, even when it receives a community note and turns out not to be true. A couple tell me they saw being fact-checked previously as a badge of honour, as they perceived these to be biased and censoring certain types of stories. Whereas they say community notes offer context and allow users to make up their own minds.
There's quite a bit of psychological research that shows that flagging something as this is wrong or this has been fact-checked and is not true could make things worse.
Melissa explains that removing fact-checking is most likely to impact not those whose views are pretty entrenched already, but the people who haven't yet taken a side on a particular issue, what she calls the movable middle.
I think it will make it difficult for those that seek truth and seek a proper understanding of what is going on to not have it seamlessly integrated on the platforms anymore.
There are also practical questions about what community notes would look like on Instagram and Facebook versus how they work on X. X has a smaller number of users and has traditionally been home to lots more political debate. It also has a very text-based feed. What these labels will look like on Meta's platforms and whether users will be up for adding them are currently unanswered questions. So why are all these changes happening? To answer that question, let's take a closer look at what's going on in the USA.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
I was in Washington, D.C. for President Donald Trump's inauguration in January 2025. Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, and a whole bunch of other tech moguls were easy to spot, seated not very far from Donald Trump's family. Donald Trump has been one of the biggest advocates for this freedom of expression argument. So is this shift inside the social media companies driven by politics, a move to avoid regulation, or something else entirely? Coming up, what's going on in the social media bosses' heads, and why are these changes happening on their sites? This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella. And from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the documentary with me, Mariana Spring. And for BBC Trending, I'm asking, can community notes clean up your feed? Since the 2024 US presidential election, X has cemented its place as the home of political updates about the new Trump administration. Its owner, Elon Musk, endorsed Donald Trump during the race and is now heading up a new government advisory team called the Department of Government Efficiency. And since Donald Trump became president again, social media companies seem to be entering a new phase. Both Meta and TikTok too are focusing their messaging on the idea of freedom of expression. I asked Sam what he thought about this shift.
As much as it's targeted towards trust and safety, I think it's more of a bigger picture where they don't want to become a target from the administration, specifically in the US at the moment.
By target, Sam is referring to the threat of new legislation that could seek to control what social media platforms are able to do. This kind of regulation could ultimately reduce the amount of money the sites can make. Unlike Musk, Sam believes Mark Zuckerberg is driven by profitability rather than having any kind of ideological motive.
So when you see Musk at rallies, giving speeches, trying to drum up the crowd, get him to agree, all of his Twitter rants that then he deletes and some he keeps up, very ideological, very much a off-the-chest kind of does what he wants. Whereas I see Zuck more of a methodical kind of thought-out approach. So he's less of a, I'm going to be best friends with you and I agree with all of your missions. He might be. I don't know. But it's more of a, I'd say more business approach of he wants to keep his platform alive, want people to use his platform.
In a public statement, Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, said recent changes are an attempt to return to the commitment to free expression, and that the company is vigilant about the impact its policies and systems are having on people's ability to make their voices heard. They also said it's important to have the humility to change our approach when we know we're getting things wrong. Lisa worked with Musk when she was still at Twitter, so I was curious to hear about whether she had any clues as to why he's making the decisions he has at X.
Twitter employees weren't allowed to be in the same floor as him, right? So we would be working in the same real time on different floors. He's just driven this relentless, insatiable need for more and more power.
What was he like to work with?
Something that I loved about Twitter and the kind of the culture there, this idea of humble inquiry. Elon is very much a teller, right? And so all the listening that happened that really helped us release features that imperfect as they were useful, you know, and the platform, people loved being on the platform. So it was very different. It was like a cold bath going from deep inquiry, humble inquiry, to a very dictatorial approach.
While Elon Musk frequently posts about politics, he's continued to argue that changes he's made at X are about an absolute version of freedom of expression, regardless of your views. He said community notes are awesome and that the counter to misinformation is not censorship, but better information. On X, he stars himself as a bit of a troll, and that can make it tricky to work out what he really believes or just what's going on inside his head, especially since he's not responded to my repeated requests to interview him. I contacted X about this episode, and they didn't respond to me either. They say publicly how defending and respecting the user's voice is one of their core values at the site. To figure out what works in terms of limiting the spread of posts that aren't true on social media, fact-checking, community notes, or neither, it also seems like we need to get inside our own heads and understand how our brains react to what we're seeing on our feeds.
There's this notion that if you bring in plurality and diversity, that it would always lead towards the most accurate or true depiction of information. From a psychological perspective, I think both have their possible benefits and shortfalls.
Melissa argues that fact-checking that goes through a rigorous process and upholds ethical principles with the aim of protecting truth can't be replaced by a bunch of ordinary users. But fact-checking on its own can't solve everything.
A lot of the sort of more recent research has questioned the efficacy of some of these retrospective, reactive efforts. Just because once misinformation is out, it tends to stick, and it's very difficult to disentangle.
She says it would be better to stop the spread of mistruths and misleading posts in the first place with, for example, features that better educate users. This is called pre-bunking, the process of preemptively debunking misinformation before it strikes.
Can we actually stop it at the starting line? Can we build something that we've sort of called psychological herd immunity, similar to a vaccine-related herd immunity, where even if your crazy uncle continues to post misinformation on any of these platforms, enough of us in society are quote-unquote inoculated, and that we will not fall for it and we will not contribute to its spread.
That can take a whole range of different forms. Melissa has worked with other scientists to design games, for example, which allow people to better understand the tactics used to spread disinformation. She's also worked with social media companies and teams like Lisa's. Lisa was involved in developing a pre-bunking feature on Twitter, which highlighted possible false or misleading claims about voting ahead of the US election in 2020. People would see a sticker warning them of disinformation they might encounter. One of the problems is that some people have come to trust who they agree with rather than who is sharing content that's actually accurate.
I think a lot of work will need to go into authentic and meaningful relationships that maybe are primarily offline and that mean that we get involved in our neighbourhoods and communities more and realise that we are more similar than different, even if we vote differently. And there's a lot of work around contact theory and psychology that, you know, sort of suggests that the strongest predictor in terms of reducing stereotypes and discriminatory thoughts and behaviours is knowing someone from the other group.
I think we've reached a point where we accept that it's impossible to eliminate stuff that's not true online, in the same way that we can't do that in real life. And when it comes to freedom of expression, that's probably a good thing. The issue, though, is when stuff that isn't true is actively pushed to thousands or millions of people by algorithms, recommendation systems, on the sites, which favour engagement over accuracy. More eyeballs means the companies can sell more ads, and that means more money.
And that's what happens when you have like a Facebook or a Twitter that's owned by one very wealthy individual, right? Well, that's controlled by a very wealthy individual. It introduces so much opportunity for harm.
Fact-checking or community notes, according to lots of the former employees of the social media companies I speak to, are a bit like a plaster over a larger problem. And that's the fundamental design of the social media sites, centered around these algorithms.
I think we continue to grapple with the question of, in this ever-evolving and overly stimulating environment, how do we design social media or design these digital spaces to guide us towards autonomous sense-making?
You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Mariana Spring with BBC Trending. My thanks to producer Marta Porzilli and Hal Haynes for mixing the programme. Our editor was Flora Carmichael. If you'd like to get in touch, my email is mariana.spring@bbc.co.uk. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
I'm Natalia Melman-Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2, and of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.